We are all concerned these days with the development of nuclear energy. We have learned already that it can do a number of nice things and also a very great number of desperately dangerous things. We have no way at the moment, apparently, of applying some form of universal ethics to research in this field. And we do not know whether or not the energy resulting from nuclear fission has any built-in protections. Probably the major built-in protection was that it did very little damage to us until we discovered how to release this energy by a more or less equal division of a heavy atom. From that time on, we have been in trouble. The energy released has been inconceivable. And the thing that more or less amazes us without very much comfort or consolation is that this energy is everywhere in space. The so-called matter that we have been accustomed to think of as more or less a dead substance is actually completely alive, far more alive than perhaps the more visible indications of vitality that we are familiar with. We suddenly live in a world, universe, cosmos of energy. And working with this presents a great many challenges. And this morning I thought we might try to just kind of ramble along and consider some of the elements and factors involved by means of common examples. Now, this problem of energy seems to tell us one thing primarily, that energy, life, is an internal factor in living things. It is not conferred. It is innate. It is part of the structure of these things themselves, and all living forms live off of their own internal energies. These energies are usually moderately distributed. They come as are needed. There is energy behind the blade of grass, but this blade of grass does not directly lead to any tragedy. It has been directed by inward laws in the use of its energy factor. Everything is using energy in some form, whether it be for personal life or collective social existence. Energy is the great mover of things, both qualitative and quantitative. And we must sometime face the challenge of what to do with it, how to use it, how to prevent it becoming a means of complete destruction for everything we value in life. Now, if we are confronted with a problem such as nuclear fission, we are also problemed with a tremendous need for self-discipline. The individual must recognize that with every opportunity to improve living conditions, he must face the responsibilities inherent in those opportunities. He must realize beyond doubt that the more power he has, the wiser and more virtuous he must become. As long as selfishness, arrogance, violence is associated or are associated with nuclear fission, we are going to be in desperate danger. In other words, we have now made a discovery that can be only handled if we grow up as living things and become responsible, intelligent, constructive, and conscientious in the use of the resources that we have developed. Otherwise, these resources are going to turn on us with frightful consequences. It's probable that, therefore, that the development of the nuclear energy field is not only most closely involved in our ethics, But without proper internal maturity, we are going to be in very dangerous situations. Now, this brings the other side of the coin into focus, something to do with internal disciplines. And here we think in terms of Zen for a moment. Zen is an extraordinary Eastern philosophy. It is built primarily upon Buddhism. It is also, however, deeply involved in the cosmological and anthropological philosophies of the ancients. Zen is a method of controlling atomic energy inside of ourselves. We are constantly calling upon nuclear fission for existence, but it is done in a very slow, gentle, and non-belligerent way. We release energy according to the disciplines which are imposed upon physical structure. If we release energy too rapidly, we are desperately ill. If we do not release it rapidly enough, we are languid and inadequate. Also, however, we realize that energy is constantly operating in our conduct. For one thing, for example, if we overdo or overtax and use more energy than we are able to supply or provide, we are not well. If we waste energy, we are also sick. So Zen has been set up as a discipline of character. We have never previously associated it with nuclear fission. But there is something about it that reminds us of the tremendous energy factor, not only behind matter, but behind consciousness and intelligence. There is a mysterious illumination process, which is more or less similar to the fission of an atom. There is a tremendous power of spiritual energy locked within the psychic atom of man. This energy he has never learned to use properly or correctly, except possibly for a very few great teachers of past ages. The development of man's consciousness resource, like the development of his energy resources, this resource has been exploited, misunderstood, and profaned. Man's consciousness was given to him for a reason, and that reason was not conspiracy. He was not made to be a thinking creature in order to outwit his neighbor. He was not created with faculties to understand and comprehend and then bind them entirely to the profit system. Man internally is misusing his resources, and this in turn has a direct effect upon his health. Now, if we take the individual and kind of look him over in terms not only of philosophy but of science for that matter, we discover that each person is a cosmos in himself. There are probably as many living entities within each human body as there are creatures living upon the earth. Billions of minute living things cooperate to make the common function of man possible. These minute things become divided, so to say, into races, nationalities. They are given locations, continents. They are nourished. They have their own system of growth and reproduction. They are also able to cooperate in some strange, probably psychic way, with all of the needs and problems of the body in which they are involved. Possibly, we do not know, possibly to these little tiny microscopic entities, man as a composite being might be regarded as a god. Maybe he is the great overbeing that is expected to control wisely and lovingly this vast habitation of creatures, which he calls his body. Here he has a tremendous responsibility because he is capable in almost any phase of his existence of forgetting his duties and allowing his body to suffer as a result. If this is if this deity, which we call human spirit, is a just and proper overlord, it will protect the body. But if it is subject to evil habits, if it becomes involved in narcotics or alcoholism, the body as a whole is under a tyranny. A tyranny, a despotism, an anarchy of the ambitions of a person paid for by the destruction of millions of lives which have been given to him to assist in the functions of correct conduct. Now, Zen approaches this matter on a very severe, but perhaps a very reasonable way. In the first place, it begins by pointing out that all excess endangers integrity. Now, this excess can endanger mental integrity, emotional, or physical integrity. Wherever the individual loses control of his own conduct, wherever he breaks or whenever he breaks the natural rules and laws of health, he is a traitor to the vast empire within himself. And this empire has ways of revenging itself. And this usually takes the form of physical debility, disease, and perhaps premature death. So the individual has a responsibility to use the energies which are provided to him from the infinite number of small energy units within his own body. If some of these units run away, we have types of disease which can prove to be fatal. If these different units do not cooperate, we have a whole group of mental, emotional, and physical symptoms which must be met or else the compound will be dissolved. Now, the purpose of Zen is not just to hold the parts together with a kind of mucilage of some kind. The purpose of Zen is to keep the harmony of the body, to protect a good government. The Zen factor in our consciousness is what is intended to be the just ruler, the wise and careful leader, more or less ordained by divine will. This is the part of ourselves that rules the rest by the divine right. It is the king in us, and we are the consequences of its conduct. To begin with, then, Zen may start by recommending the simplification of life to save the individual from wanton waste. Now, we think of waste very largely as a physical byproduct of activity. We think of waste as something that must be removed from the system or found in some way disposed in the community. But actually, what we are really concerned with is the conservation of the life factors by means of which our length of life is largely determined, and also the quality of that life in its relationship to its environment. The moment the individual ceases to be serene, in that moment he becomes dangerous to himself and others. Now, we know that most persons are suffering almost constantly from small naggings, from minor things that happen that distress and annoy them. Zen is a discipline to recover from these unfortunate factors. The purpose of Zen is to smooth out, to make even, the way of life. Now, this does not mean to make it monotonous. It does not say that we cannot have constructive emotions or mental activities, but it means that negative, destructive releases of energy are dangerous. It is just as dangerous for the individual to have a temper fit in terms of his relationship with the lives within himself as it is to have some foreign nation release an atomic bomb. Anything which destroys balance, which destroys life or misuses it so that it becomes self-destructive, is working a very great hardship not only on his own body and his own life, but upon the community and the world in which he lives. Therefore, it becomes very important for the person to realize that wisdom, in a sense, is a way of life. It is not a mental activity alone. It is the power to discipline conduct by intelligence. Now, this is something we all need. But in order to attain this, it is sometimes necessary to secure special training in such a process. We know that our educational system does not teach us self-discipline. It simply creates habits. It causes us to descend or hide ourselves behind a single attitude and remain behind it as an economic factor as long as we live. Actually, however, the consciousness within ourselves is in demand in a constant leadership. We have to learn how to rule ourselves. And the man who rules himself is greater than the one that taketh the city, according to the scriptures. Zen, however, is not one of these punishing things. Of course, the Zen monk, under discipline, is provided with intensive opportunities for self-discipline. If he doesn't accept them, he probably will be rejected from the order. But the primary purpose for the layman, the individual who is not actually a member of the Zen community, is to take those parts of the doctrine most useful to himself and apply them to his own immediate needs. The first thing he must do is place a watchfulness upon himself. He must become increasingly aware of his own conduct. It is not that he should become bound to constant personal criticism or analysis, but that he must, in a reasonably relaxed state, observe what he does, how he does it, why he does it, and the consequences. Now, this type of thinking is not very common these days. We live by impulse, which is an explosion or loss of energy. We live with regrets, more energy wasted. We become angry, that is practically nuclear fission. In all these different things, we are constantly misusing the most important thing we own or possess, and that is energy. That is the life within us, which will unfold and evolve with us through all eternity. It is the reason that we are alive. We are a mysterious center of energy surrounded by manifestations of itself. These manifestations go into every function of our structure and body. These manifestations include bones, nerves, muscles, glands, and all the different divisions of our physical structure. This energy division also includes our thoughts, our feelings, our beliefs, our doctrines, our hopes, our fears, our worries, our agitations, our happiness, and our misery. All of these represent expenditures of energy. And we are told now, and probably it is true, that the world at this time is short in energy. This shortness of energy, the supply is not adequate. This shortness of energy is present in each of us. People are not as happy as they used to be. They are not as reliant. They are not as thoughtful. They are not as dedicated to principles. The average person today is wandering around, mostly wasting energy. One of the fine ways of wasting it today is to devote it to television programs. If you watch those long enough, you can suffer from complete exhaustion. And don't forget the energy necessary to produce those programs. Calling upon resources in short supply, we use what there is wastefully. We make no effort to try to find a legitimate value in what we do. Most of our time, we are perhaps wasting energy by being sorry for ourselves. Another type of waste is to constantly worry about the world. We do all kinds of things in which we use up energy, fully aware of the fact that the use is going to be non-productive. We can get annoyed at anyone we wish to be annoyed with, but in the end, we have simply wasted more energy. Revenge is a total loss. Anxiety, not much better. All of these different ways in which we waste or use or expend energy have a tremendous effect upon ourselves. in the human being, almost all energy waste is also involved in destruction of tissue and fabric. Wasted energy is depleting the resources of the body to recuperate from disease or to continue the process of growth and repair necessary to its survival. The moment we waste energy, we endanger the one commodity upon which we depend for everything. Therefore, in Zen, we are taught, as best as we can be taught, to conserve energy, to prevent ourselves from any willful waste, to prevent ourselves from any extraordinary attitude which is going to bring a negative reaction. The moment we overuse energy, we get a reaction. We find a deficit taking the place of the exhaustion. We find ourselves more tired, less able to carry on the constructive works of life, less patient, and gradually less functional in our daily habits. Therefore, every waste is resulting in a deprivation. We are some way being penalized for the misuse of the powers at our disposal. Zen now comes into the matter as a philosophy of life. It is based upon a series of attitudes. Zen does not take the Pollyanna attitude that everything is wonderful. It takes a very simple attitude. Everything is as it is. Everything is real, and reality has a reason. In fact, reality is the prime which we are all working with. When we keep peace and keep faith with reality, we have very few problems. But when we break faith with reality, we begin the disintegration of our entire compound. We will never be as good again as we were before we exhausted our energy resources. To try to meet this exhaustion, we take all kinds of pills, vitamins, etc. We go to nutritionists to find ways of building up energy. But the first and important factor in building up energy is to keep the energy that we already have, to use it usefully and constructively. If we are very deeply involved in a worthy cause, and we find that we are not able to carry on as well as we used to, there might be a cause for energy supply in terms of nutrition, in terms of better habits of living. We can take the necessary vitamins and minerals to build up energy that is lost through legitimate activity. If, however, we are wasting all we have, get more pills so we can waste those also, we are not gaining much. We will never really gain until nature and nature's ways are honored, are given precedence over every attitude of our own life. In religion, we get letters quite frequently from people who are confused or disturbed by religious associations of one kind or another. They say that so many people who claim religion and really believe in it never practice it. They are actually constantly speaking about brotherhood, but they do not create brotherhood in their environment. They are told to be merciful, but they are still critical. We are told to love the strangers, so we can't even love our families. Most people keep all the virtues for themselves alone. They love themselves. This, however, is a very little social value. It's much better, therefore, to realize the importance of a doctrine that is not valuable because of its name or because of any of the exercises associated with it. The value lies in the individual taking the disciplines necessary to reform his own nature and qualify himself for a better level of energy and a better destiny in this world and the worlds to come. So as we watch this tremendous demand on energy, more electricity than ever before, and we find all the natural resources of society gradually diminishing, we have a very sad thought somewhere in the back of our minds. What is going to happen when the coal is all gone? What is going to happen when we run out of petroleum? What are we going to do when the various resources of energy which we now have are not only overtaxed beyond the possibility of meeting the demands, or even the amounts that we have now will gradually fade away? How are we going to get along, for instance, when we have no way of maintaining this intricate culture that we have built upon a tremendous internetwork of energies? Well, some of the scientific people are hoping that by that time we will be able to tune in on nuclear energy, that the only source left to us is the source of universal life itself. Here, however, we have as yet come a very short distance, but we've already learned that we are now fooling with something that is extremely dangerous. We want the energy. We are dying to keep up all of these things that we have. But if we keep them up the way we're going now, we're going to die from the consequence of keeping them up. We are going to be in a very desperate situation because we are not going to be able to handle a higher degree of energy unless we raise our own level of integrities. We are no longer dealing with materials that we can buy and sell. We are dealing with a universal power that extends beyond space and time, that runs and works according to laws inherent in itself, and there will never be a way in which the human being can alter those laws. He must gradually learn to abide by them and reconcile his own conduct to the requirements of infinite energy. This is going to be quite a little job for him. So we must begin to prepare for it. There is a tendency now for fear to come in and make us a little more cautious. We are discovering a little more every day the danger of our own mistakes. We are realizing that we cannot go on being foolish, even vicious, without ultimately getting into difficulties. Somewhere in the ancient background of things, commandments were given to us by sages or saints, or some believe by the finger of God upon the crest of Sinai. We were given ways of life, commandments. We were given lessons, morals, fables, parables, to help us to find out what the divine plan for man really means. Now, many may say that there is no proof that these are divine revelations. Now, maybe there is not any actual proof, but there is another kind of proof, and that is the disaster that occurs when we break them. It is not necessary for us to find out who made them. The only thing that is necessary to find out is how we can keep them, and by so doing, to protect ourselves over the long range of the future. It might be interesting to realize a possible source of energy that we have neglected is the energy resource within ourselves. There is probably enough energy in each human being, if improperly used, to blow the planet out of its orbit. But there is also enough energy in the human being to make it possible for him to gradually and methodically take over the complete direction of his own existence. He can meet all the needs that can arise, because these needs are satisfied by resources within himself. And when these emergencies arise, which he must face, the resources come forth to meet them. But the resources can't do anything unless the individual takes a kind of voluntary pledge to keep the rules. We are now greatly burdened by man-made rules, by laws, most of which are inadequate. We are burdened by a complex structure of legislations, of values, of standards, of ethical confusions, which we do not really know what to do about. There is no solution in trying to keep all of these rules without knowing why they're there or what they are about. We can be law-abiding forever and still die young. There's more to it than this. And the thing that is more to it is the realization that all these laws are related to the rules governing our own lives, that we must begin to think in terms of keeping faith with realities. We can no longer live in a kind of fool's paradise. We can no longer say we are each of us entitled to complete independence. We must no longer think in terms of how much liberty we can gain or how much authority we can destroy. The problem is to realize that we must transfer our allegiance from the insubstantial substance of physical policy and restore it to where it belongs, the infinite rule of a divine plan working in nature. If we can keep the rules of the divine plan, the rest will take care of itself. If we break these rules, no amount of legislation can give us survival. We will perish because we break the rules of life. And these rules of life are the guides by which energy, life energy, is directed, controlled, and released gradually and properly in the unfoldment and evolution of living things. So we can try for the one thing that the Bible has told us, namely to be still and know. This is Zen. Zen is to be still and allow the rules to work, to keep out of the way of our own best good, as we term it today. We must gradually come to the condition and point where we permit natural laws to work their own ways. Now, this does not mean a blind acceptance of hunches or mysterious motions or feelings within ourselves. We need to be disciplined. We need to know what we are doing. But we must prepare ourselves to obey rules that we are now completely ignoring. One way is to help this out would be to get a better educational knowledge of the abilities and liabilities of human life. We should know more about the human being, what he can do and what he can't do. We should understand better the structure of his body and its relation to his consciousness, his mind, his soul, and his spirit. We need to find out what constitutes a true normalcy. A normalcy in the face of heaven and not normalcy among the abnormalcies of human beings. If we can find out the basic pattern of what is best for us, we can then begin to build. Now, many people feel that they have tried to live according to what was best for themselves. But then again, if the level of interpretation was not high enough, if the best was not good enough to provide survival, then the best is not worthy of very much attention. The best must be that which is closest to reality, not that which is closest to self-satisfaction. We must become more and more aware that that which is best for all is also best for us, and that we are no longer simply separate entities struggling for survival like a number of bugs in a water barrel. We are more than this. We are creatures living together, bearing witness to millions of years of growth and development. Creatures so incredible that no scientist has ever been able to truly understand the structure of the human body. So remarkable in its mentations that the processes of the mind remain unsolved mysteries. And also with bodies so extraordinary that no machine ever created by the human being can approach them. Bodies that depend upon miracles performed every day for survival. Bodies that are moved by energies which we have not been able to really discover and which will serve us well if we keep faith with them. All of this is part of a contemplative life. And a contemplative life begins by smoothing out everything that might cause waste, that anything that is lost through excess of attitudes. Therefore, it is not wise for the individual to physically over-exercise because he is using too much energy. Socrates was approached on this problem once, and he said he would never walk or take a walk unless he was going somewhere. The idea of going around the block 50 times never occurred to the old Greek. And yet he was strong enough so that when he was in battle, the enemy separated and went on each side of him. They didn't face him. So physically, moderate and right. Rhythmic, not excessive. Every part of physical motion should be more or less dominated by artistry. The human body is a magnificent thing, and it is particularly wonderful to the artist who knows how to use it. The body is something that requires a tremendous amount of aesthetic understanding, and the most delightful and possible protections of all of the functions and properties of the body. So if the body is not overtaxed, it will in an emergency rise to almost any occasion. A body that has been properly taken care of then becomes a strong help in time of trouble. Whereas a body that has been worn out with nuisance values is of very little use to the individual who owns it or anyone else. Then we go into the emotional life of individuals. Emotional energy is more subtle than physical, but it is of the same quality. There is a mysterious nuclear fission of the emotional atom. It is subject, the same as the physical, to a tremendous amount of research to understand its way of function, what it really is, how much it can do, and where its boundaries are. All possible means should be used to make sure that the emotional energy does not come into conflict with the physical. If the emotional comes in, there is a tyranny because the physical cannot cope with the emotional. That is always at a disadvantage, which is lower, and the physical is lower in its processes than the emotional. So the emotion is a guardian of physical health. And when it ceases to be a guardian and simply uses the body to satisfy or gratify its emotional propensities, it is then a dictator, a militarist, an anarchist, tearing down the union of the parts which make up the human personality. So we take the emotional nature and find that there are two general kinds of emotions, those that enrich and those that impoverish. Everything that is unpleasant, negative, unfair, unreasonable, selfish, self-centered, overambitious, and so forth. All these things are misuses of emotional energy. Whereas love of beauty, kindness, friendship, affection, cooperation, these are emotional virtues. And these virtues protect the physical body because the superior has the power to improve that which is inferior. But the inferior cannot rebel effectively against the superior. So we have in the emotional level what would be called in a meditative discipline the need for the gradual relaxation of stress. Now that you can fight an emotional stress, you can fight it by more emotional stress. You can use all kinds of disciplines to whip it into action as though it were an animal trainer. But at the same time, none of these things will work effectively because they simply create more energy extravagance. The simple answer is if you just quiet down, you don't need any other remedy. If you just simply relax away from pressure, not in any sense of the word neglecting a proper duty, not giving up important emotional commitments, but simply wasting no emotion on negative attitudes. All negative attitudes have destructive effect upon the physical body, and the emotional attitudes of millions of people have also a tremendously detrimental effect upon the emotional nature of the planet. They create wars, revolutions, despotisms, and anarchies. They turn people against each other. They justify war, rebellion, and catastrophe. These are all more or less dependent upon lack of emotional integrity. So that we can look around us and see how important it is that we really try to keep the emotional nature under some type of reasonable control. Once we begin to control it, we find it's rather nice. We find that it's much nicer to be happy than miserable, and that we have less to burden us if we forgive than if we continue to nurse grudges. If we keep our minds off of ourselves and no longer suffer from self-pity, we have a new contentment rising in our own natures. And all of these processes together make physical life more stable. They give us greater securities. They give us more friends that can be useful and helpful. They make us more charitable and also more welcome in the lives of those around us. Emotional attitudes, therefore, should be watched. And the next time irritation rises up, drop into the Zen attitude. Be very quiet. And allow some relaxation to move in on you. Instead of building it up and adding by imagination to the fault that is already overabundant, keep quiet, or very gently try to understand the good behind the situation. If somebody annoys you, be quiet for a moment and realize that this is an opportunity not to be annoyed. And that when you are able to make most of that opportunity, you have had a marvelous lesson in self-discipline. So wherever anything happens that would almost certainly cause you to be excited or displeased, realize that this is a test, a kind of an initiation, and that if you are able to pass this test, you have stepped forward in the real development of your own humanity.